Last time you were like, oh, I'll take a picture. And I was like, you could just pull it out.
Like, just
yeah. Yeah. So I don't even feel like you can take notes if you want. Even though I took my binder early. I know we do have a hard stop at 11:30. A number of people have additional commitments. So, first of all, thank you for being here. We are so pleased with the public participation, the number of people who have come and are interested in what we're doing and are doing the work. So thank you all for being here. We were just saying maybe we're going to have to find a bigger room. But this is the biggest room in the Senate building. So we're going to work that out. But we're glad you're coming. So don't feel like we tried to squish you all in here. We're glad you're here. So the LG will join us in just a few minutes. This is the December 12th meeting of the Governor's Early Education Childhood Commission, and we're calling it to order at 10:06. So we will start off with the approval of the meeting minutes. Those were sent to you beforehand. They're also in your binders if you need to see them. Any discussion or a motion? Okay, a motion from Sid.
Second.
A second from Dr. Miller. All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, great. We're going to start off today. We talked a little bit about the preschool development grant at our last meeting, and so I've asked Nuna to give us an update. We have a few things that we wanted to make sure the commission was aware of, so we'll start there. Thank you, Nuna.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you. Before I give an update as to where we are now, I just wanted to share a little bit of background on the past year. I think a lot of this was covered at the last meeting, so I don't want to be too repetitive, but in the fall of 2018, the Office of Child Care, in collaboration with other state agencies and stakeholders, submitted an application for the PDG, or Preschool Development Grant. This was through the Administration for Children and Families, and our work primarily focused on three activities: the development of a statewide needs assessment on what the programs and services are that are available to children and families, and some additional updates to the data that we've had in past reports, the development of a strategic plan that's informed by that needs assessment, and then our application also focused on the framework and really figuring out whether there was a need for and benefit to having a universal early childhood website, the purpose of which would be to educate parents and have a way for early childhood experts to be able to share information and everybody to sort of be on the same page when it came to the services that are available. So with that in mind, we have partnered with our friends at the University of Utah to complete the needs assessment and strategic plan, and the needs assessment is in the final stages of editing, so we're very close to having a final needs assessment done, and the strategic plan will be informed by one more session that's out in the field, and those are really beneficial because, as you heard from Dr. Ball at the last meeting, those focus groups and parent input have been really instrumental in ensuring that we have all of those perspectives included in the needs assessment and strategic plan. So those two deliverables will be ready soon, and we've also developed a framework for a universal website in collaboration with other state agencies and community partners, and based on the feedback we've heard from parents. So that work has taken place over the last year, and early last month in November, we submitted a renewal application, and really what the Administration for Children and Families wanted to see was how we're going to take what we've done in this first year and build on it long term. So this is a three-year grant that we have applied for, and that would be to periodically update the needs assessment, the strategic plan, and build out the universal website. So our activities are focused on those three items. And last year we heard on Christmas Eve, so it was a really fun Christmas present, and we may be hearing around that same time frame, and the start of that three-year grant renewal, if we were to be awarded, would be in January of 2020. And like I said, for a three-year period. But I will also say that it's a bit more of a competitive process this time around, and we've heard that they're anticipating awarding 24 grants. So that's where we are.
And they did a huge amount of work in a short amount of time to put that application together, so we appreciate that. Any questions for Nuna about the PDG and where we're at? Okay, I failed to recognize that John Pierpont couldn't be here today. He's traveling. So we have Greg, his deputy, here filling in, and we appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So our next item, like Nuna said, our initial plan for this meeting was to talk about the strategic plan and the needs assessment. But because we've decided to go out for a little bit more stakeholder input and those kinds of things, they weren't quite ready for this meeting. And so as we were talking through what would be the best use of our time today, we thought this might be a good opportunity for the commission to kind of jump in on almost a case study. What's one area where we have multiple entities doing some good work, and they can share where they're at and what's going on. I do intend for this to be a working meeting, which means I have the expectation that you'll be asking some questions. At the end, we'll be thinking of some ways that we can connect some dots, both within the work you're doing with each other and also with our many providers that are out in the field. So be thinking through from your lens, your experience, and then your agency, how we can help connect those dots and how we can help move this one piece of the work forward. We selected professional development because it's something that I anticipate is going to come out in the needs assessment and in the strategic plan. And so it felt like something that's not going to be, I didn't want a one-off initiative for this commission to be thinking about. I want something that we're going to want to continue to work on. So that's what we're going to do today. I'm really grateful because we have three experts here to share with you what they're doing. Natalie Brush from Head Start is going to present for us. Sid Dixon from the State Board, who you all know, will present. And then Casey Hutton from the Office of Child Care will talk about what each of them are doing on professional development. So I think what we'll do is we'll turn the time over to Natalie. We'll let her key us up. I think we'll probably let her get through her presentation, and then we'll stop and see if we have any questions specific to Head Start. And then we'll move through. Does that sound good?
Yes.
So Montana's got your presentations ready to roll. I know. Big thanks to Montana. She does all the minutes. She makes this actually function. I know.
I'm just going to introduce you to myself. I'm Natalie Brush. I'm the Executive Director of the Utah Head Start Association. And I just want to give a shout out. I have the privilege of representing Head Start throughout the state. So we have a lot of people here to back me up. So I just wanted to recognize there's many of our Head Start programs in attendance today. So.
We probably all can remember one teacher who really changed our lives. And when we think about that teacher, what we think about is the relationship that they had with us, how they motivated us, how they pushed us, how they supported us. And it's really those teachers and those experiences that can be life-changing.
Interactions matter.
Interactions matter.
Directions matter.
Interactions matter.
Interactions matter. Interactions matter because they engage kids. They draw children to the resources.
Interactions matter because research shows that children who are in warm, supportive environments have better improvements in academic skills as well as social skills.
That was just a brief. Just to give you an idea, that interactions matter when it comes to professional development, especially in Head Start. I'm going to tell you a little bit about, some of you already know about Head Start, but I'm going to give you a little bit of context so you can kind of know how Head Start operates. So this is a map of our state, and you can see it's very colorful and very divided. We have 12 programs in Head Start, very unique, and many of you probably already know this, but there are individual grantees with a federal grant that goes to a local entity, and so...
So sorry. Ignore me. Make my grand entrance.
But just to give you an idea how diverse our Head Start programs are and yet how consistent our professional development is. So we have from the top, we have Bear River, we even have Ogden Weaver, we have Davis School District, Utah Community Action, we have DDI Vantage Early Head Start, Mountainland Head Start, Kids on the Move Early Head Start, the Youth Tribe. We have Rural Utah Child Development, which covers this area. We have Southern Utah University, Group for Kids, Early Head Start, and then Centro de la Familia, which covers a lot of areas for the migrant farm workers. So Head Start is a very diverse group of programs across the state, so you can kind of see representative. There are 2,173 employees throughout the state, and with that, 654, which is about 30% of the employees, are teaching staff, which basically are teachers, assistant teachers, educational coaches, and ed managers. And you notice that 30%, that means a lot of our employees are family advocates. They're also transportation, health, and all, and so professional development is very complex in Head Start. 36% of our staff are proficient in another language, so that is another unique opportunity that we have. There are currently 5,724 preschool-aged children that are served throughout the state, and 1,951 infants and toddlers. And of that, 35% of our kids both are dual language learners. That's another unique opportunity that we have with Head Start is providing that dual language. And another unique is that Head Start is looks at disability, which there are 15% of children with a diagnosis, meaning that they have a service plan that we're kind of looking at. So you can see it's a very unique throughout the state, looking at both rural and urban, and also the children that we serve. So it creates a unique professional development landscape. So the professional development system, what our mission is in Head Start, is we are driven by our Head Start program performance standards. Many of you probably know that. So a program must provide ongoing training and professional development to support staff in fulfilling their roles and responsibilities, so that's various roles and responsibilities. And the goal is to improve child and family outcomes. So outcomes always drive professional development. So what that means is that professional development needs to be individualized based on their roles and where each staff comes at in the process. Many of you may know this as well, that we try to hire parents in our program. So some of them come to us various levels of education and skills. It's also data-driven, and it's research-based. So not just providing a service professional development, but it needs to be driven by data, which includes outcomes, and it needs to be research-based. So this is kind of a little model about how our professional development works. I'm sorry if I'm standing in front of anybody. But basically, we look at qualifications, hiring a qualified workforce. So when they come in, there are standards for Head Start teachers when they come in as be a teacher. But we look at where they're at. Because again, we mentioned they could be an assistant teacher or an aide or oftentimes a parent. So where do they come in? So we look at the skills and abilities of the staff. We look at data analysis, and as you saw in that video, we use a tool called FLASP, which we'll talk a little bit about. And we measure different domains, and when we look at class, we use those outcomes to push back in to course correct for individualized. So if you look down here, then we set up individualized professional development plans, and that coincides with coaching and mentoring. We used a program called practice-based coaching. So we look a lot at feedback and self-assessment with the staff, and then that helps to develop those individualized plans and a lot of self-reflection. And then with ongoing professional development, standards basically say that you need at least 15 clock hours annually. Our programs easily exceed that. So ongoing in-service training, and this isn't necessarily always circular. There are various places that we will enter in. And then the evaluation process looks at where they're at. So with the data, where are the children performing, and where are the outcomes? And then we look at where the skills are and then course correct based on that. All right, so we talked a little bit about CLASS. CLASS is the class assessment scoring system. So Head Start programs throughout the nation use CLASS. That was the design designated by the Office of Head Start. And so you can see that Utah is ahead nationally and of our region in scores of these three domains: instructional support, classroom organization, and emotional support. And just like the video showed at the beginning, the focus of class is on interaction. A lot of assessments do look at the classroom environment, so how the classroom is set up and the curriculum and how that is. Class is a unique tool in the fact that it measures the interaction between the teacher and the student. And the thing that's great about that is how many of you have had a teacher that you've seen and naturally they just have this wonderful skill and they just work with children. The thing that's great about the class observation and class training is that you can be able to improve those interactions. So we believe that's really important in with the kids. So the other thing we can do is take these scores individually by staff, their observations, and we can actually target areas. So targeting instructional support. One of the other things to note is that Utah Head Start is in the top 10% nationally with our class scores. And it's based upon continuous improvement. So, how do we track our professional development? Through human resources and the supervisor, they track those individualized professional development plans. And Head Start being a federal program, we also are required to report. So most of our programs use programs called a Child Plus, which is a software program where we track all of our student outcomes and our professional development, all of our staff. And then we report on the previous year's program information report, which is the PIR, which is available. online. So you can see program information. So programs are required to report how many teachers, what their salary is, what their education level is, and professional development. And then the largest one, as you know, any federal program requires it to be monitored. So federal monitoring reviews require that programs are monitored on staff qualifications, minimum qualifications, and professional development opportunities. So we're highly monitored. This talks a little bit about, they kind of asked about what our landscape is for our degrees. So currently we have 293 lead teachers. Many of you know that there's regulations to have where lead teachers are, assistant teachers, and also aides in the classroom. So currently over 57% of our lead teachers have bachelor's degrees. And then you can also see, starting here at advanced, there's about 2% of our advanced remaining PhDs or master's program level, the majority are being bachelor's, associates 19%. The child development associate, which is one that we promote, they receive, would be 6%. Related or unrelated just basically means that they received not a bachelor's degree in early childhood education, but they received something related or unrelated, and then they receive additional training in early parent education that helps to supplement whatever degree that they had when they first came in. And then this last one, 6%, are so you can see the majority of our teachers have a degree, our lead teachers. And then looking at assistant teachers, you can see the largest number we have. So again, for the advanced degrees and the bachelor's degrees, about 9%. Associate's degrees, and then the largest one being 45% would be our child development associate, which we're encouraging them to get. And then again, related and unrelated, and or no degree, and then obtaining their CBA. So we have a large amount of our assistant teachers, so you can see the career pathways would be that assistant teachers would move through the CBA and hopefully have an opportunity at some point to get their bachelor's degree and then hopefully move into a lead teacher position. So helping, and even parents as they come in, helping them to move through getting a child development associate, eventually an associate and a bachelor's degree, is moving through. And talking about how to get those, making that available for them. So we were asked a little bit about some of the gaps. So you can see that whenever you have a federal grant, you're required to have a lot of data and a lot of monitoring. So there wasn't a lot of limitations or gaps, but one of the things we recognized is, as we're looking at this larger early care and education professional development system, is understanding not necessarily the qualitative data, but the quantitative data, or vice versa, excuse me, the quantitative data is just understanding why people leave. So this will, the gap is, we do basic exit interviews, so programs have access to information, but one of the things that we would like to know is, we have stats on turnover, but we would really like to understand why people leave and where they go, because we have some assumptions. We make some assumptions in our field that sometimes people are moving through various systems. But I think it would be important for us to really understand, and as we look at this umbrella of professional development, is how do we determine how do we recruit better, how do we retain those qualified teachers, and then through that, how do we help develop a system where we can support one another as people move through that. So that was just one of the gaps that we identified as that reasoning behind that. And then as far as our goals and priorities, the first thing obviously would be to provide ongoing in-depth training and coaching to staff on topics that are specific to the population of children we serve. That includes, as you notice, some of the populations are children with special needs. So targeting specific training on children with special needs, also trauma-informed care, also dual language learners. So we're targeting these things that are things that teachers in our programs need to have skills and abilities in. And then, of course, class being something that we provide training for. The second thing is obvious, preparing children for kindergarten. What is it going to take for them to be prepared to learn, to be ready for school, and also to become lifelong learners? So, and then the other thing is that it's really important to Head Start is that we collaborate and share data with USBE to identify and track longitudinal child outcomes to inform program management. It's really important that we know where kids are going and how they're how that what their outcomes are so that we can, again, course correct. We look at outcomes when they enter kindergarten. We would like to know how they're doing first, second, and third grade so that we can kind of align our curriculum. We can align our assessments so that it makes a difference so that we're not sending our kids to a kindergarten and they're starting all over with those processes. We feel like that there's a lot that can be done to align that. And then that goes with the last one, which is align educational service models to include shared professional development. For example, if programs are aligning others with the school districts, is aligning professional development so that teachers are speaking the same language. So if kids are coming in, and that's all informed by the Head Start, obviously the Head Start performance standards. So I have a tiny slide.
You are.
I have a few minutes for a question.
Questions anyone has? Recommend?
Thanks. We're talking about interaction. It's mainly teacher to student interaction or child interaction. I guess that includes interaction between kids because that's critical too. And I guess that's part of the teacher's expertise is to manage the interaction between kids because that's the peer interaction, I think, is extremely important also.
Yeah.
Right? I imagine that's part.
I think that's true. And I don't know, Dr. Miner, if you would mind or if anyone else would like to hear, but I have a couple of our program managers that are here. If you want to hear exactly how the class, how they measure the interaction, how do you, would you share?
Sure.
Thanks, Patty.
Hi, I'm Patty Stoney. I'm with Utah Community Action Head Start. I oversee the Head Start Education Social Services Program. So basically how class works or what we train our teachers is to not only build relationships with one another, but building those relationships with the teachers and the children. So as far as with those relationships, of course, it encourages more open, communicative sort of interactions with the children. And as they're talking and working with the children, they encourage children to share and participate with one another. Typically what you would see in the classroom is children, sorry, you guys already know. What you would see in a classroom is the teacher will set the stage, so to speak. So in each center, she is working towards what is she going to provide in those centers. So it might be housekeeping, it may be blocks, it may be manipulatives. Set the stage for when a child, when they break for to go into their centers, the children are allowed to go into whichever center they choose, but she has activities there that are scaffolding their learning. And she may strategically choose children at maybe a little bit of a higher level to interact and participate with children that maybe are at a level that may be a little bit below them. So as she's sitting there working with the children and talking with the children and scaffolding their learning, she is encouraging those other children to share and exchange their knowledge and their activities with the children in that group. So it's observational all the time, it's ongoing, and it's a very planned activity. And it's not only just through the centers, it's during meal time, outdoor play, it's through every type of activity that goes on in the center. Any other questions?
Natalie, would you mind just defining CDA? I always get a little sensitive to acronyms.
I know, Child Development Associate.
And that's not an associate degree, right? So who provides those?
Various entities.
Okay.
And we've had that discussion, too, amongst our other groups, is someone get them online. Head Start actually provides them. We have some trainers in-house to provide those. But there are online programs as well. So that's a really good question. Because we would like to provide a good avenue to get at least get that basic requirement.
And can you tell me a little bit more about those CDAs? I mean, is there kind of an industry standard for what those are? Is it just all over the place? Is it?
Good question. And we've talked about that as well. There is a governing a body that governs that.
Is that a national?
Yes. So I don't know, there's probably other people in this room that probably know a little bit more about the CBA governing body than I do, but it's a really good discussion to have as far as how to make that a little bit more accessible to us. Some of our work group that we have to talk a little bit about, and Kelly can smile, or Casey can smile, but is we've talked about this, how to best get CBAs available and we get the piecemeal system.
Yeah. Okay.
Even USBE. Sometimes people get them online. It's whatever. It's inexpensive. And those things. So there is a governing body.
Okay.
And an accreditation process.
Sorry, can I just clarify something? So our elite teachers in the classroom have degrees. So
right.
Most of them have a bachelor's degree. So it's just a teacher that has the
CBA.
CBA.
Yeah. And that was
about that.
So, yeah. Thank you.
You talked about one of the gaps being having access to accurate turnover data. I'm wondering, is there any relationship between turnover and professional development expectations?
Between Head Start, you mean? Specific?
Yes.
Or across the field?
Head Start specific.
I would say specifically it's not professional development expectations because there's a lot of support. Our guess would be that people are moving into other fields or burnout or whatever it is. So that's the thing we don't know. That's something we would like to know a little bit more about, where people go. Not necessarily why they leave, per se, but where are they going? And there's some assumption that maybe if people are moving into either K through 12 teachers, becoming teachers that way, so people leave preschool to go into the K through 12 realm, that would be an assumption. That's not always the case.
Okay. Yes.
I know, as you mentioned, that Head Start tries to hire lots of parents who don't have these degrees, but it's professional development or parent development, career development for those parents who frequently will come from high-risk families, which is fabulous.
Yes, exactly. And you can see the importance of a career pathway because sometimes you do have to build in-house. Because it would be nice to hire, especially lead teachers, but we really would like to help bring people up. And so if you build in-house, for example, you have parents, what can we provide for professional development to help them become possibly a lead teacher someday? And that's what we are, you kind of look at. So that's a really, really good point.
All right. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Superintendent Dixon, it's your turn.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I feel really blessed to be in this room with so many experts, and I also feel honored to even be called an expert. I am not an expert in early childhood. In fact, when I was a school principal, I used to take classes for all my teachers so that they could work on other things and have a break from the classroom for a minute. And my kindergarten teachers would always say, "Thank you, Mrs. Dixon, but no thank you." Because I would get the kids so wound up. For me, it was all about play, and I'm not sure how much learning went on. So I do have staff in the room who will support me and correct me if I run astray. But my background and my expertise really is in the area of professional learning. And I so appreciated that Natalie already teed that up and talked about the elements of quality professional learning. So I'll touch on it briefly and hopefully can answer questions that you have. Well, I'm going to go back and start. Yesterday I was in a school where 90% of the students in the school they qualify for a free reduced lunch based on family income. And I went into a first grade classroom and had a tour from a little young man named Nicholas. Nicholas was just turned 6 recently, and Nicholas took me around the room to show me his learning goals and how he was meeting his goals in writing, reading, and mathematics. And there was a different color code for each goal that was posted. And he was excited to show me that he was number 6, by the way, so their names are not posted, but all of their learning goals and progress are posted. And he was excited to show me that he had just earned his orange dot for learning how to read so many words in a certain time frame and a certain level of words. And then he took me to the blue star that he had just learned for mathematics because he could count to 100 in a certain time frame and he could add so many numbers together and he passed everything off. But he was most proud of his writing rainbow. And he had the entire rainbow colored in with the exception of one little section. And then he went to his tote tray and he pulled out his little tote and a lined piece of paper that's the same kind of paper that many of us wrote on as children. And he had written this beautiful little writing about how to build a snowman. And it was color-coded in that he could show me where he had put a capital letter. Yellow dot was for capital letter, green dot for lowercase, orange for a period at the end of a sentence. And he wanted me to know that he was very proud of the brown dot, showing that he had proper closure at the end of this paragraph, teaching me how to make a snowman. And then he read it for me, and that printing was beautiful. Nicholas was an English learner. He had a beautiful little accent, and he came to the school at midway through kindergarten and had not attended preschool or kindergarten to that point. But he had an amazing extended day kindergarten teacher, so he was in an extended day program, and an amazing first grade teacher who really had the skills to bring Nicholas where he needed to be. As I talked to the teacher, she pointed out students in the classroom who had engaged in quality preschool that they had at the school, extended day kindergarten, but for the bulk of the students, they were coming and going from the school and had a variety of experiences. And it was the quality of instruction that that student was getting, that Nicholas was getting, in his first grade classroom, coupled with the half year that he had in an all-day kindergarten program, that enabled him to show me his yellow dots, his green dots, and his brown dots, that enabled him to get blue stars, orange circles, and a field in rainbow. And for him to articulate and pull out a piece of paper and say to me, this is my best work, and I'm very proud of this, and this is why I'm proud of it. So that's what we hope for all of our students, to be able to be like Nicholas, regardless of background, to experience quality programming and quality teaching so that they can be prepared. So as Natalie talked about how important it is to support teachers through quality professional learning, our board has a strategic plan that's really focused on these four goals. And I want to highlight both our early learning goal and our goal around effective teachers and leaders, because we feel like they go hand in hand. I'm so proud that when I go around the state now, business leaders, community leaders, and my neighbors are talking about early learning and know the importance of it. And that wasn't the case a couple of years ago. I found myself fighting a lot of political battles around the importance of early learning and this notion that maybe government is trying to intervene in families. But really what we're trying to do is support the families and lift up the families. So we're very focused on these two elements. And the strategies that we have around these two goals are, again, to promote high-quality instruction in early learning, and that's pre-K through third grade. We're finding that, you know, who doesn't love their kindergarten teacher, right? Kindergarten teachers are awesome. But a lot of our teachers don't know what they don't know. They've either been trained a certain way or they were mentored by other teachers who maybe had practices before. Research was out about high-leverage skills and high-leverage practices. So we do see a lot of good instruction going on, but we think there's a lot of room for high-quality instruction to be had. So that means ensuring that our teachers are up-to-date on instruction, that our students have access to extended-day kindergarten. In many of our schools and in many of our districts, they don't have access, and they certainly don't have access to high-quality preschool throughout the state. We want to ensure that we engage our families with young children so they know how to increase vocabulary and create those warm environments that Natalie talked about. When it comes to effective teachers and leaders, educators and leaders, we want to ensure that districts are supported and charters and private schools and everyone is really supported with what they need for high-quality professional learning. And it takes leadership at the local level to make that happen as well. In this school where I interacted with Nicholas and many other students, the principal was so hyper-focused and relentless about high expectations for the students, the families, and the teachers in her building, and it was really paying off. In fact, in their school, their proficiency rates are not only above what might be expected of schools that receive Title I funds, but they were also above many of our middle-class schools in that particular district. We also need to lean in a little bit on our preparation programs. We feel like they do a good job, and in some cases a great job, but we need consistent quality preparation for everybody that's in the preschool and early learning space. So, I don't expect you to read all this text, this is more visual than anything, but to think about how we get at these core elements and competencies around professional learning. Natalie really outlined that cycle of effective professional learning very well. Thank you for that, Natalie. And so we actually have high-quality professional learning standards in code. I don't know if you're aware of that, but they are codified thanks to Representative Last and the legislature passing these through. So when we give out grants and professional learning is connected to that, then we always try to build in that statute, a piece in code that reflects back to what that looks like. We also have the Utah Effective Teaching Standards. We have high-quality preschool standards. So we have this framework and map. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's there. We just all need to be connected to those elements. We have educational leadership standards. And this summer, we're kicking off our Standards Implementation Institute. And we will have a pre-K focus at that institute. And it matters not whether you are a private provider or a public provider. Everyone will be invited to participate. So we track our professional learning data through various means. I don't think we do a good enough job of tracking the effectiveness of it, but we know how to do that. So let's just kind of go through some of the data about our workforce. We have a system called CAPTIS. I've forgotten long ago what it stands for. It's a system that right now is being held together by chicken wire, so it's kind of prickly, and we're working on this new database system. But it really houses all of our workforce data. So within that data system, we know, again, just around preschool, that we have 405 preschool educators listed in the system. And you can see the bulk of those, 333 have preschool special education or early childhood licenses. And of course, you all know that if you're in a special education preschool, that you have to have that special education preschool license. And then we currently level our licenses. So level one is beginning. That would be year 1 through 3. Level two is sort of like a certified teacher that's beyond their provisional years. A level three would be if you have a doctorate degree or a national board certification. An APT is some kind, it's some minimal expectations of a bachelor's and other areas, and a district or a charter can choose to hire you. And then 47 temporary licenses means that they're working on some form of licensure. They qualify, but they're not yet licensed. And then you can see no license and then going through an alternate route to licensure. So I swear there were 28 ways to be licensed in our system. And we're trying to cull that down. So we have a new system that will be put in place this coming year that's already in board rule. And you won't see all those various things. But you will see some amalgam of people that come from a non-education background and want to be in this space. And so we have ways to support them. And I think that's something where we can all work together to ensure that the kind of professional learning that they're provided with to get the licensure is of high quality. And then you can just see a breakdown of all of the degrees that are earned for those that have these varying routes to licensure. So we do have some gaps, as I mentioned, in our professional learning. I think we have a knowing-doing gap. So we have the research that's out there. We have some best practices. We have everything. We have a framework. Like, we are not lacking of knowing what to do, but we're not always putting it into play. So for teacher knowledge, we want to make sure that they know the research and they have the evidence-based practice, but they also have the experiences Natalie pointed out of coaching and support while they're trying, and feedback, as they're trying to hold those skills. And then we also find that some of our teachers come into the early learning space and they'll say, I'm an early learning teacher, I want to work in preschool. Sometimes it's because of the level of the students, but sometimes we find that teachers say, I don't feel confident in mathematics, or you know, I really don't have the literacy background. But they love the age level of the students, and there are things that they like about that. So really making sure that our teachers have the confidence the confidence that they need in content areas is really critical for us as well. We are one of the few states, for example, that does not require the reading science test, the essentials of reading. It's here somewhere. I'll come back to it. And some states do that. So, again, I think we have a phenomenal workforce. I love our teachers. I love our teaching workforce. But we need to support them in ways that shores them up. So the rigor of the preparation they have, really the kind of professional learning they have. And then, as Natalie pointed out, being really data-driven, now we have the PEAT. Is that the best name for a preschool assessment company? So we have the HEAP for kindergarten and the PEAT. And it's a starting point for us to have some good data. Okay. So as we think about our systems, goals, and priorities, again, we have everything that we need in place. We have the framework. We have the teacher effective teaching standards. We have professional learning standards. We have pre-K standards. And in order to achieve our strategic plan to ensure that students are ready for their future, we need to get this early learning bill passed. And so we have a bill that we have placed before committee. Our board is in support of it. And it has these basic elements. So the heavy lift, and I think it's about $18 million, Patty, if I'm remembering right, an ask for professional learning. And a lot of you have weighed in on that professional learning bill. And I know it's something that sounds nice and never gets funded. We're at the point where this is really essential. If we want our teachers to be effective, they tell us we need support. We need support in the classroom. When we get these very little kiddos in our space and they have all these varying needs and we don't know how to differentiate instruction and we don't know how to support their needs, they need professional learning and feedback. So teachers are asking for that. And that's a big part of the lift. The other is alignment of all of these high leverage practices, our assessments, curriculum. I had a call not too long ago from a kindergarten teacher. This was a couple of years ago, but I know Patty and others have had these same calls where they'll say, you know, I've been teaching for a few years and I just heard about the kindergarten standards. Like every time I hear that, I just think, how is that possible that you didn't know we had standards? So we still have some work to do, and our teachers are always, they're just so happy to get any kind of resources and standards and support that they can. Now, I tell you that story. That's an anecdote. Corey's looking at me like, Sid, don't bash our teachers. That's an anecdote. And, you know, 99% of our teachers know that we have standards and they're using them. So we don't have a lot of instructional coaches in the pre-K space. And we have them in other places, especially in our tested subjects and elementary, and a few in secondary schools, but in the pre-K space, we're really lacking in people in the schools that have that keen expertise that can link with all of you here, as well as linking good practices in the classroom. So the other thing that we want to look at is the science of reading assessment. That's the assessment I was speaking of earlier. And in the pre-service level, a lot of our schools do a nice job with reading, but we don't know in the early childhood space if they're really getting what they need when they come out of pre-service. So this assessment would help us with that. And then really thinking about these high leverage practices that I've already talked about, so I won't belabor that. And again, going back to if we look at our preparation programs and what they could do, really focusing on that assessment as they exit the programs and say, do they really know the science of reading, as well as can they show that they have these competencies in place in the early learning standards. And last but not least, just what are those high leverage practices? It's a lovely phrase to say, but what does it all mean? So with high leverage practices, we're really talking about the cycle that Natalie so aptly described, and that was using the student assessment data to really analyze instructional practices. We often will look at that from a student standpoint. We don't often use student data to look at the gaps in teacher knowledge and skills. And as I visit schools and see great professional learning communities occurring, they're putting this into play. They're using the student data to say, the students in my classroom have these gaps in their knowledge and skills, and what does that mean for me? Do I have the knowledge and skills then to fill that hole based on the student data? And if not, who do I go to, where do I go to get that support? So that's what we're talking about with that cycle. And that's why we need all you around the room collaborating on this to make sure that we have the best practices in our classrooms. Really thinking about the kinds of strategies to make sure we promote, we'll bold it student engagement, but I would bold this word active, so that it's not passive learning and a lot of busy work, but real active engagement. I think, Dr. Miner, you spoke to that really well. Student, not just student to teacher, but student to student, and the kind of engagement and play that's very active around learning. And then are we systematically designing instruction towards a learning goal? This is what I saw in Nichols' classroom. This was happening for every child in first grade, and it was happening for every child in the kindergarten and preschool classroom. So it was really this systemic plan throughout this school of instructional design that was scaffolded for students based on where they started and their learning goal. And then how are we giving feedback not only to teachers but to the students? Are we helping them along the goal? The fact that Nicholas could show me not only the feedback he was getting, but he was self-assessing, and that was happening with all of the students. Really then, thinking about that respectful learning environment, Natalie showed this in her video, and really talking about how important that learning environment is for students. Really, in a lot of our schools, especially, that are highly impacted by poverty, that they're coming from a place of stress, and so being able to be in a school setting, or a preschool setting, where they have a stress, I don't want to say stress-free, but a warm, caring, supportive environment is critical for our kids. So I think that's it. We'll take questions.
Okay. Thank you. So any questions?
And staff, I see staff a little nervous. Is there anything you want to add that I missed? You know what it must feel like with these brilliant people who are superintendent to stand up and pretend like she knows what she's doing.
No, I know that feeling well.
If you have any questions that you need, that's
Thank you.
I didn't embarrass you.
Dr. Miner.
Now, going back to Nicholas, I was a little worried about him being so dutiful, stressed, that I that it's neat that he wanted to be good and successful and dutiful. But how do you do that and not make it stressful? I'm not saying he was stressed, but and actually, and going back again to the supportive environment where the students don't feel like they're competing against each other, but they are supporting and having fun learning from each other.
Yeah. A brilliant question. I always have the same worry. In fact, when I see anything on walls, I go, oop, a little bit. However, the difference in this school is that they move together as a team. So they have team goals and class goals, and that's the real visible part. And then they have individual goals that's more of the private part. And so if you see a rainbow on the wall and it's his, other kids aren't looking at his. They're looking at the way they're coloring their skin. It's the team goal that's front and center, and they move together. And the teachers and the paraeducators and the parents in the room really engage in the professional learning as well. And that's the thing I appreciate. It wasn't just the teacher carrying it all, but everybody moves together and being very skilled. So the kids are getting what they need based on where their gaps are. The first thing I look for, Dr. Miner, when I walk into a school is how do the students look? And the way they feel is shows on their faces. And you can see their energy. I was in a school one time where shoulders were down, heads were down. I saw poor instruction. This was in a charter school that no longer exists, so I can say that about the school. But it was like you just walk in and you feel the stress and the tension, and it doesn't feel right. Within, oh, I would say 10 seconds, you can gauge a school. I was in a high school yesterday where I saw kids pouring out into the halls for lunch, and that can be frightening. This is a large high school, and I was right in the middle of it, and kids were happy, and they were talking about what they were learning, and they weren't stressed, you know. Of course, they were going to lunch. That helps. But just private conversations with kids. I love talking to kids because they will tell you. Nicholas was so excited to talk to us. He could hardly stand still. You know, he was dancing while he was talking. So I sat down by a kid that was struggling, and she could tell me her learning. So it's really the culture in the school. And it's the principal, the leaders in that school set the tone. You know that. That's a powerful question, Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent. Appreciate it. Yep, I think we're good. Okay. All right, and Casey's going to do last child care. Thank you, Casey.
Okay, so I'm kind of eyeing the clock a little bit.
You're okay.
We're okay.
Don't stay.
Okay. Yeah.
Do your first question.
Oh, did I kill it? Okay.
Take a lead from Dr. Miner. We don't want you to be stressed about your time on it. Good. We're all moving together.
So I'm Casey Hudson. I'm a program manager at the Office of Child Care, which is in the Department of Workforce Services. I oversee policy and professional development. And our office receives funding for federal block grants called the Child Care and Development Fund, the CCDF funding. And that funding is targeted for licensed child care. So that's both center-based programs and those that are operating in home, as well as the families that utilize those care options. As part of our CCDF funding, we're expected to have a professional development system. The goals of our system are to increase the quality of the staff by training them, and hopefully that will increase the quality of the care that the children receive. We also hope that our professional development will give people the tools to feel successful in the classroom with young children, to help retain them in those positions. And then we know that we have a high turnover that is kind of part of the early childhood sphere. And so we have training that's for people who are just right there, new and into the field itself. And then we also know we have long-term people who have been in the field for quite some time. And so our goal is to have professional development opportunities for the whole spectrum. In our office, we use results-based accountability for our strategic planning. So the results that we're hoping out of our professional development system is that Utah youth and early learning professionals are well-educated. So we have two core elements in our system. We have a career ladder system. This is pretty common across state CCDF funding. The career ladder is really an educational pathway. It's kind of levels that build upon each other from very basic, like health and safety, basic child development, kind of topics in the early level, all the way through advanced degree. So step by step, you can move across these levels until you get to the place where you feel comfortable as kind of the end point of your educational pathway. And then we also know that finding that professional development when you're an early childhood professional that's working in a private business, it can be very expensive. So that's a big barrier to receiving professional development. So the next part of our kind of core elements is having a lot of scholarships and kind of financial aid available to programs and professionals who want to take this class. So our workforce training is really made up of our career ladder approved classes, which some of those are in-person clock hour classes that we've approved through agencies that we partner with. So some of that is like the Department of Health and their Top Star program. We approve their training for career ladder credit. We also have USP. They do their CCFP program training. We approve that for credit. And then we have partnering agencies around the state that really host a lot of our training, and we've approved clock hours. We also accept continuing education units on the career ladder. So that's like a specific designation for professional development that usually comes from a university or an international program that kind of designates something as a CEU. We accept professional activities, which is our way of acknowledging kind of professionalism in the field. So if someone goes to a conference and is learning in a conference environment, or if they're part of a committee, we can give some credit for that. And then we accept college credits on our career ladder as well, to move across from level to level. The way that we decide if an opportunity is career ladder approved is that we kind of look at these three competencies, and I brought them with me because I find that it's easier to remember what they are if I can see them. So we have the Utah Core Competencies, which is kind of like a professionalism handbook for childcare. It goes over kind of what is expected for professionals to know as they work with children. So we look at that when we're looking at approving things. We look at the Utah Early Learning Guidelines for 2-3, and that's kind of like a milestones plus strategies book. So it shows you at what age a child will be able to do something and what strategies can the childcare provider use to help a child along that development. And then our friends at USP would be very familiar with this one, standards. We use that for our classes as well. For our demonstrated competencies, it's kind of exactly what it says. The time in the career ladder where we kind of pause, and people as they're advancing through, they need to demonstrate that they are competent in what they have learned. So we do that through the CDA, which there's a question about what the CDA is exactly. So the Child Development Associate is run through the Council for Professional Recognition, so that's a national body. But the training components of it can be achieved in a multitude of ways. So Head Start has a way to do the training components. Office of Child Care offers classes that are open to the public to come for training through our Care About Child Care agencies. And you can, of course, do the training online as well. Then there's an observation component where you have to actually find a professional development specialist in the state to come observe you teach in your classroom. So that's kind of a demonstration of your competency. There's a portfolio component of it as well, and that's standard across any preparation for the CDA. So then all of that gets submitted into the CDA council. They review it, and then they provide the CDA certificate. So that's how that program works. So we use the CDA. We also recognize the NAC, which is the National Administrator's Credential for Child Care, so it's an administrator role. the school-age demonstrative competency is done through the Utah After School Network, and there's not a CDA for school-age necessarily, so they've modeled one very similar to the CDA. High school skill certificate is done in our public high school through CTE program. So if you take the child development courses in that, you can get a high school skill certificate. And then there's also the student teaching and parenting competency as well. People have done that in the college environment. So you can see all of what I just talked about far exceeds our minimum qualifications, which are to pass a background check, complete 2.5 hours of pre-service training, and be at least 16 years old. And that's from Child Care Magazine. So I want you to keep that in mind as I go to the next slide, which talks about some of the achievements of the professionals we have in licensed childcare, because I think it exceeds, you know, the minimum qualifications. And those people have done that kind of through their own intrinsic desire to advance in the field. So we have a professional development registry as part of how we track the workforce for our reporting for our federal grants. Now we mentioned lots of reporting. So our registry had, as of November, 12,245 members in it. Those aren't necessarily private child care, like licensed private child care people, because the registry includes those all. If someone had come to one of our Care About Child Care classes in person, then they automatically would end up with a profile on the registry. So that could be private child care, Head Start, public school, or people like me, where I'm in the field, but I don't actually do direct care. So looking at that large membership, if we break it down to just the licensed child care professionals, there's 5,654. And then you can see there's, I did a further breakdown of directors, so people who are running child care programs, but we also know they're often in the classroom as well. Teachers, so lead teachers in programs, and then family child care licensees, because they both own their programs and are training directors. Of those, we have 234 with either an associate or a bachelor's degree. And then looking at those certifications, I just did those doing direct care that I was confident in doing direct care. And you can see the most popular certification is that child development associate. So our data limitations in our registry system. We can auto-capture a lot of training data if people come in person to our classes because it gets captured through attendance in our system. But the rest of it is reliant on people submitting in their certificates. So if they did them something through like the CEUs, or they did college credits, they got their CDA certificate, we rely on them being active and uploading it into their profile. So that is the limitation that we kind of work around. We're never 100% confident in how much of that data we've collected from the public. It's really whether they've had a reason to do so, and if they haven't, then we don't necessarily know if they've done it. The upside is that everything that is turned into the Utah Registry for Professional Development is verified and approved. So we know that anything that was submitted, if we got eyes on it, then it met our standards before it goes on to someone's transcript online. So one of the things that we're trying to do to combat that or to encourage people to participate in the registry is we've done some rebranding and updating. Previously, the registry, it's been long-standing, but it was called the Child Care Professional Development Institute. It was a bit of a misnomer because it didn't actually provide training like you would think an institute would do. And it also had child care in the title, which sort of made it sound as only for people in child care, but we also know we have people who work in Montessori schools who are kind of like in the in-between, and they're welcome to track their professional development in our system. So we rebranded a few years ago to the Utah Registry for Professional Development, trying to encourage people who need a place to store their professional development documents to use the registry. We are also working on developing a new website with some easier data collection features. So our gaps. We know that our Care About Child Care agencies have done a really great job in marketing their in-person professional development classes. So when you talk to a lot of private child care providers, that's instantly what they think of when they think professional development. But for some of them who live in rural areas or who just their schedules don't really permit them to attend the in-person classes, I think that they don't necessarily know what else is out there for them, and that can be a barrier to attendance. Same thing with the awareness of the Utah Registry for Professional Development, that there's reasons to use that system that I think in the past weren't as much marketed. So we do some financial aid associated with the career ladder, so a lot of people would upload their information because they wanted to get that incentive, that financial bonus. But for people who weren't eligible for the bonus, like they didn't work enough hours in a week or their program was full time or other things like that, there wasn't a real incentive for uploading. So, and we know from the National Workforce Registry Alliance that the best practice is trying to really include the entire field. We've also looked at how we can do a better job to support online professional development opportunities for those students who can't come to in-person classes. There are multitudes of things available online. Like, you can do all your CDA training online, but what we often hear is that it's expensive because it's done through private companies. So we're looking at ways that, you know, we subsidize the in-person classes that are held at the Care About Childcare agencies. So are there ways that we could help reduce those financial barriers so that people can facilitate their professional development online? But if they're interested and they're doing that because they're intrinsically motivated, we certainly don't want them to not be able to put their financial gains to Google goals. And then we need to keep working on our coordination. We have a lot of things that are set up to build upon each other. So we have CDA programs to help people get a CDA. We support TEACH, which is a scholarship program that you've had the teaching for the education of children and Katie over there overseas. But trying to help people navigate from, I took some classes to, oh, my classes helped me get a CDA, to, oh, my CDA might actually be worth college credits and I could go to an associate degree. I think it's not as obvious to people in the field that those things link together, and we could do a better job kind of connecting the dots for them. So looking at our result again, our goals that we have going forward are to continue to increase awareness of the professional development opportunities that we have, that they're open to anyone to participate. We do focus a lot of our funding on CDA cohorts in the Care About Childcare agencies. So those are kind of like low barrier is we can make them. You do have to apply, get accepted into a cohort to participate. But after that, the cost of going to training is completely covered by the Office of Childcare, so there's no cost for the training that you do. It's 120 hours of training. You get CDA competition along the way for free, so someone helps you with your portfolio, prepares you for your observation, what's that going to be. There's also a test that they take and they help guide them through that process. And then at the end, we cover the $425 fee. Like I mentioned, we have the Teach Associate Degree Program that over the last 3 years, we every year have added more money from our budget through a contract with UAEYC to provide more scholarships for private childcare to embark on getting their associate degrees. We have the Early Edu kind of online collaborative, and that's been a great collaboration between the Office of Childcare, the Head Start Association, USB, the Utah Education Network, and SUU to work together to make some classes available online. They're college-level classes. We pay for an adjunct instructor as well as a course overseer who is current faculty at one of the institutes of higher education. And participants can go and take that class at no cost, and then at the end of the class, if they have a high enough grade, we encourage them to get their credit transcripted by SUU, and the cost to them is just $63 for a free credit for a class. So then we're working with our higher education institutions to make sure that they accept those credits when they come on, hopefully, to move on to their degrees. We're also working on increasing the number of per ladder clock hours taken, as well as building this connection between coming for professional development and implementing the best practices, which I think both Natalie and Dr. Dixon talked about. So one of the strategies we have is really kind of tied in with our child care quality system, which is new, but we award points on the child care quality system, or if a program has had staff participate in professional development. If they get points in that area, then they can also get a small bonus to help them continue to pay for their staff to get ongoing professional development. So we know ongoing professional development is quite important. So that's one thing that we've started funding. We also fund, like I mentioned, kind of the bonus for individuals themselves if they choose to move up the levels of the career ladder. And we're working on implementing our new coaching program, which also uses practice-based coaching, which Natalie mentioned, to help with providers implementing what they've learned directly in the classroom. And I think that's the end. Any questions?
Questions? Please.
I was trying to think about how the online stuff is linked. So they would find it on your website. So there's a UEN, I'm just thinking of the UTeach, the online.
The UEN, yeah. The way that we try to market that program is that for private childcare, we have kind of an email blast system, so anyone who's in the registry we have their email address, and when it's time to open up the application window, then they get an email blast from us with the details about how to apply, and there's a short application that they fill out. If they are participants from private childcare, then we have a rubric that we use to kind of prioritize slots if we have more applications than we have spaces available. For our USP participants and Head Start participants, they do it a slightly different way, but they also get an email out to their program to explain that the application window is open.
So, Mike, if I may.
Please, yeah.
So, an underlying question that I have for us as a group connected with this that Casey is, if I'm a parent and I'm searching for high quality, how would I know where to go? So, if I go to the UEN website, there's a great section there for parents. I bet if I go to DWS, I can find some stuff. If I go to the health department, we've got all these websites and resources all over the place. And I'll bet as a young parent, I wouldn't know the first place to go, especially if I am I'm a second, you know, my primary language is not English. So it just struck me yesterday as I came upon a group of parents that were at this school, and they were learning English at the school, and the instructor was talking about school-based terminology, so trying to teach them just what's happening in your child's school and how to interact. And I'm thinking the same thing here. So a lot of our kids are in programs. We're talking about how do parents access information. So you don't have to answer that, but I think it's an important question for us to all think about. We have it everywhere. Whether it's professional learning for teachers or whether it's information for parents, how do we do a better job of making sure everyone can access that? Because I'm embarrassed that I didn't know you had these EdU online college courses, and it's awesome. And my staff knows that, but like, I don't have to know everything. But
it would be hard to know.
I should probably know that. So thank you for having me.
Dr. Martinez.
What we're talking about here is preschool, right? Preschools that are called childcare, but all childcare should include early learning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, and is, are there certain, again, requirements that they have to meet to be a childcare and be addressing education, early education?
That is a great question for our cat in the audience. Because she was talking about licensing, and yes, there are licensing regulations to open a private childcare. They're different depending on the setting. So I don't know how much detail you want for that.
But yeah, but if they're childcare, can they advertise themselves as a preschool without meeting certain...
Right.
There are no rules for differentiating your branding. Is kind of how it's looked at. So you can call yourself a preschool and be all play-based. You can call yourself a preschool and be, you know, another sort of focus in early learning. So childcare is zero and up as far as we like, you can still 12, 0 to 12. You can call it whatever you want.
Okay, other questions, please.
I could just add to that. In fact, I'm with the Private Child Care Association, and one of the things that they're really focused on is the new program in terms of quality, quality program, and the marketing to that. A lot of the preschools are marketing to that. In fact, James is the president of the association of England. This is a matter of information.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I just wanted to add to that, too, what Kat was saying about the variety of different approaches. I'm from Voices for Utah Children, and what we've learned is that there's a lot of different interest level from parents about how they want their kids to be engaged throughout the day. So you have a lot of different providers who are using different cultural and pedagogical approaches based on community interest and family need and differences. And I think what strikes me that sets Office of Child Care's role apart as a little bit different in terms of professional development is the barriers that participants face in trying to access professional development. If you're tending 16 children in your home with another child care provider up until 6 o'clock when parents pick up their kids, and you've had 16 kids from 0 to 12 all day, even online learning is a lot. It's a lot. So I think you guys have done a good job of working around some really, really significant structural and systemic barriers that as childcare providers are trying to do what parents need them to do so that they can work. Sometimes those details preclude them participating in these sort of structured activities.
So one other thing I wanted to throw in is that in child care licensing, it is out of our purview to regulate curriculum, and so that's where it gets really tricky in who can call themselves what. So we really have to stay out of the curriculum piece.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank
you.
And that makes it harder for parents to know what they're getting, maybe, unless they really investigate well.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't have options for them to really find.
And I think we're hopeful at the Office of Child Care that the child care quality system will help kind of demystify some of that as we continue to roll that out and have in our public search that's available on our website, have it very clearly indicated the public rating level of a program and have some as parent-friendly as we could explanations of what each rating level meant. But you're right, there's some things that you would really have to ask each individual for.
Yeah.
Do we tie the degree of child care assistance payment to the quality?
In the child care quality system, there's an additional payment that is related to the quality rating. So the base subsidy payment for the child remains the same across all rating levels, but if you're rated in the higher two quality rating levels, then you do get an additional payment for each subsidy child.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal for that is part of professional development. Our hope is that also will help programs continue to pay for their staff to get their training. And we saw, like I think Anna made a great point, there's a lot of barriers to private child care accessing professional development, but we see that they do and they want to, and we really hear that from the community, and that the success that they feel when they complete an early ed class and the change that they see in their program is really substantial.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you, Casey. Okay, I know some of us have a hard stop at 11:30, so we've got about 10 minutes left. Again, I want to thank Natalie and Casey and Superintendent Dixon for your time and effort, and those that helped you to get the information together. Thanks to all of you. We wanted to discuss, and I apologize for missing the first part of the meeting, and I'm not sure how much discussion happened before, but we did want to talk about next steps and kind of now that we have this information, we've had some good questions. I think we have a better understanding about where some of those gaps are, and some good suggestions about areas that need some emphasis. One of the things that Karen and I talked about was the potential of putting together a working group to really focus in the details on some of those gaps and issues, and maybe having some of you, we can work on membership and timelines for that working group. Is that something that the commission's interested in? I just kind of want to open that up and facilitate your thoughts before we close the meeting. So, please.
Yes, so Natalie and I had a conversation earlier because as part of Early Childhood Utah, which is an advisory group to this board, Natalie chairs a subcommittee of that, and they're doing some work in this space.
Nice, good.
We don't want to be duplicative.
That's what's good about this meeting is what is happening in the space, what isn't happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, and I just want to tell you, those of you on this committee know, so Casey is representative from Office of Child Care, myself, and USBE is on. CAP also with child care licensing has been involved in some things that we're doing. We also have UAEYC. We have child care providers, private child care providers. So what we've done is bring in a large group of people just to talk about this. And I think the thing that we realize is we are a little bit lacking in resources because we're volunteering. So one of the things we're trying to do right now is do a workforce study. So we actually want to know, some of the things we've talked about is looking at, so we're looking at recruitment, we're looking at retention, we're looking at advancing, and we're looking at acknowledging the field. And some of the discussions that we've had, and I know many of you have been involved in these discussions, is credentialing.
So, you know, in other fields, especially nursing and other, and some of these fields, it's making it easy so that there's stackable credentials, so that it's easier to get where you need to be. So we've kind of talked about this idea of where is Utah right now in professional development, where is a national standard that we'd like to be, and how can we kind of bridge the gap in between and provide those resources so that people who are in the field, parents, assistant teachers, child care providers, who are family providers, if they'd like to advance in their career, how can they do it in a stackable way so that they don't just have to go get a degree and then go get a job. That's never going to happen for some of these parents who enter the workforce at various places. So like the career and technical colleges, they can enter in at various places and receive some kind of these trainings and kind of move up, is some of the discussion that we've had in our group. So what I'm telling you is that sometimes we're, I think we're a little limited. So this group, we wanted to kind of present some recommendations, possibly support some additional resources as far as studying this better. We feel like we have to understand, like if we present it on our individual things, but understanding as a whole where we're lacking, how we can utilize what we currently have, and then where we would like to be as a state. So we are currently working on that and coming up with a survey, but we're limited in really like, you know, Google Form or something. We want to actually get service providers to fill it out. To answer some of those questions. Where do you start in your salary? Why did you go into the field? Why would you stay in the field? Some of those questions.
And I really like that model, and I want to be clear, at least from my perspective, that this idea of credentialing and licensing, I don't want it to be as it sometimes is, you know, looked at as a barrier to entry. I want it to be the exact opposite of that, that it's an encouragement to entry and that we make it easier, and there are these pathways that allow people to, varied pathways, yeah. But I think actually what we have actually makes it more difficult because it's so disparate, and you know, we've got people doing things all over the board, and it can actually probably be discouraging that some people do spend resources on providers, and you know what they get back and where does that lead them moving forward, it isn't as helpful or as efficient as it could be. So I really like that direction. Thank you.
Yeah, can I ask a clarifying question? So, Natalie, do you have anyone from the medical community? Like, I'm looking at Dr. Stevens here, and I've learned a lot by just sitting with him and what you're doing. I'm wondering if you have that kind of representation on advisory.
We don't at this point. Well, advisory, yes. In our subcommittee, because we're specifically targeting the workforce,
right.
We've just kind of brought the entities together that are currently dealing with.
What you do on the broader advisory group?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So,
your subcommittee is part of Early Childhood Utah?
Yeah. So there are five subcommittees. So there are other subcommittees, ironically, too, and I was going to tell you, Nicole's here, that are working on credentialing in other areas. So we're just talking about, like, early learning in this one, but this does bleed over into other areas. For example, if it's toddler credentialing, we're talking about, like, other... So there are other issues that involve early care and education that are not just teachers. In that space, and so just be aware, especially in the Department of Health and Human Services, substance abuse and those kind of things, there are credentials, and they talk about it on the advisory. But our group is just looking kind of at early learning, 0 to 8, too. So we're kind of, it's the 0 to 8 realm that we kind of are looking at, because there's that crossover. So Jamie and Jessica, and also special ed, which is so we'd be happy to have some advice from you of how to proceed.
So maybe one thing we could do, Natalie, is task you guys to come back with recommendations to us as to what you found. And in that meantime, as you're preparing that, ways that we can be useful in helping you. And if there are members of this commission that want to... be involved and participate, I'm sure you'd be open to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. And if you want to know who your representatives are, and I don't have anyone specifically from Human Services, just because of the early learning, but Cody is involved in, especially the infant toddler credentialing. So that, definitely.
Is that acceptable to the
time frame? Because we were kind of thinking it's nice to have like a next time.
Yeah, so we have our next meeting in March, and then in June. We want to be wary of your schedule. I know there's a lot going on, but if that's a time when you could come back, present to us, I think that would be
Yeah, absolutely.
It'd be great for the group.
So. In this group for us, we actually appreciate a timeline because I think you could probably study this for
sure.
years.
Yeah.
But I think coming up with some tiered recommendations
yep.
that we kind of talked about is just that where are we at now here, what we found, and where can we go next? And this is not going to be solved within, you know, a short period of time.
Sure. And that's where I think we want to go. At least at that meeting, we can kind of get together, look at those tiered recommendations, kind of chart a path forward in very practical terms about how what needs to be done at the legislative level, at the, you know, the state level, the provider level, to start to implement some of those
Absolutely.
Recommendations.
Thank you.
So.
Does
CCU have resources that they don't have necessarily resources?
No, it's all volunteer. So, like I said, that we utilize in our group what resources we have within our own position. So, a Google form is you know very useful, and then we utilize our distribution method to kind of find out. So, one of the recommendations could be actually to commission a greater study.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
do have people yeah. from the University of Utah and on Weber, what Weber State University, on mm-hmm. there, so they have access to study some of these things.
And that's what I'm, that's what I'm wondering if we could, I mean, obviously we have resources at the higher ed level, you know, Utah State and University of Utah. There's, we can shake the couch cushions and see what falls out, if there's some opportunities there to maybe.
But I think we can try now a bit.
Okay.
And just kind of see what information that we get in case we need to speak. That's probably not true. Not the case, but I think we can try this. Initially what our group said is let's try this, get what okay. some information from, because we really wanted to get to the teacher level and ask them. Because a lot of times, again, we're making assumptions based upon the whole field, and we'd like to get at least a pretty good idea of teachers and frustrations that they're having, what benefits are available to them, why, you know, what is, you know, keeping them from continuing
yeah.
in their field.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can get a good idea in a wide variety of settings, then it gives us a better idea, and then we can say, this is some of the limitation in the data that we have, and there's a new adjunct professor at the special ed department at the U who's joined our group and is very fascinated in participating in this.
Okay,
so
good.
I think we'll utilize mm-hmm. some of that and their expertise and then get back to you and say, this is probably where we should go next.
Okay.
That
perfect. Yeah, yeah. Everyone okay with that? I mean, hearing no objections. I think mm-hmm. we're good to go. Okay. In the last 30 seconds, is there anything that any other commissioners need to bring up? Yeah, I do want to state that our next meeting we're going to take a little road trip, not too far from here. And although it's not directly related to early childhood learning, it is definitely tangentially related. We're going to go down to one of our new homeless resource centers, and have the meeting there. We want you to see the facility. We want you to hear and learn a little bit about this new model that's being implemented, and we're excited about that. So we're at the one on 7th and yeah, the Geraldine King. I want to say it's on 7th and just 7th South and 250 East. Yeah. Sorry.
We'll get you that.
We'll get that out to you. But thanks again to our presenters. Thanks to all of our providers and others that are here in the room with us. We appreciate you being here and your support and input. And I would look for a motion to adjourn. Second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, we stand adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.